The first case on the Northern Panel's docket today for oral argument is Crystal Bay Lending Partners versus JMA Boulder Bay Holdings LLC, cases 69386, 70,000, and 70125. Mr. Frankovich, you're ready to proceed.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is John Frankovich. I represent Crystal Bay Lending Partners, the appellant. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Sure.
This is an appeal from the District Court's order granting summary judgment in favor of the respondent, JMA. The judgment required Crystal Bay to turn over $4 million that it had recovered from the guarantor, which represented the permitted interest portion of a $15 million judgment that Crystal Bay had obtained against that guarantor, the Wittenbergs. It was a guarantee of the $9 million junior loan that Crystal Bay had made to the borrower. In so ruling, the court interpreted that the intercreditor agreement, which was between the senior lender, Marshall, and Crystal Bay, Marshall being the original senior creditor agreement, was Crystal Bay as a junior lender, the court failed to recognize the fact that the loan had been amended by an amended agreement. And specifically, the court relied almost entirely on paragraph 8B. And 8B referenced a reserve account. And the court said you can't collect under the reserve account because it's been reduced to zero. Clearly not recognizing the intent of the parties in amending it. But the court failed to recognize the amendment, and in doing so, failed to recognize the amendment of permitted interest payments, which is important in this case. They're called permitted interest payments for a reason, because they're permitted. When it was amended, you could collect those outside of any reserve, and specifically outside of the subordinated interest reserve. Originally, permitted interest payments could only be collected from the subordinated interest reserve account.
But wasn't that, and I hate to interrupt you, but wasn't that once the senior loan was paid in full?
Yes, it was always subject to all of these conditions terminated, including the intercreditor agreement, until the senior loan was paid in full. But under the subordinated interest reserve account, which was the $2 million, permitted interest payments did not require that the senior loan be paid.
They were my understanding is that's how it was established in order for the junior lender to be able to get those permitted interest payments only from that account, the $2 million.
That was the initial intercreditor agreement did limit it to the subordinated interest, but it was paid in full so that they were guaranteed to get paid permitted interest payments, they being Crystal Bay, for the initial term of the agreement. But when they extended it, they eliminated the requirement, because the definition of permitted interest was payments solely from the subordinated interest reserve account. They eliminated that, which meant you could collect subordinated interest from any source without limitation, and specifically outside of any reserve. Well, and I want to follow up on your question, Justice Peregrine. Crystal Bay did subordinate many of his rights to the senior lender, but they never, never subordinated their right to collect permitted interest. And paragraph 3 of the intercreditor agreement specifically provides that Crystal Bay has a right to collect permitted interest even when a senior default exists. Now, as the term of the initial loan, 2 years, came up, Marshall and the borrower wanted to extend the loan. Crystal Bay agreed, but only if there were certain conditions, and that required the modification of the creditor agreement. The parties incorporated those modifications into the amended loan agreement, which was drafted by Marshall. And contrary to the findings of the district court, the Marshall and Crystal Bay negotiated the terms of the modifications. Those modifications and amendment to the intercreditor agreement are important. The parties acknowledged that the subordinated interest reserve account no longer existed, had been reduced to zero. The limitation that permitted interest payments could only come solely from the subordinated interest reserve was eliminated. Mr. Bay could collect permitted interest payments, quote, outside of any reserve, language that the district court never even stated. There was a new note issued by the borrower specifically requiring the borrower to make permitted interest payments. Originally, the payments came solely from the interest reserve account, not from the borrower. There was also a new guarantee where the Wittenbergs guaranteed the payment of permitted interest payments. And they also reduced the stay period from 30 days, from 90 days to 30 days, which allowed Crystal Bay to sue sooner, which was meaningless under the interpretation that the district court did. And more importantly, the senior lender, Marshall, consented to each one of these. We're now four generations later of a lender, which is Chick and Pay, and they say none of these provisions still apply.
Mr. Frankovich, what is the effect of paragraph 2.3 in the loan modification agreement that appears to cap the interest payment to $75,000? I'm struggling to see how that fits with the current interest payment provision that is contained in the definitional sections of the original creditor agreement.
The $75,000 was the monthly payment of permitted interest. And that was in the original agreement, that was the amount, and in the subsequent agreement, that was the amount that the borrower was required to pay each month, $75,000. If you extrapolate, that comes over 2 years on a $9 million, it's $900,000 a year. Over 2 years is $1.8 million, it approximates the $2 million.
I see.
And that's how they got to that. But importantly, as I indicated previously, the district court's ruling is contrary to every one of these amendments, every one, specifically the ones that recognize that the subordinated interest reserve account no longer existed and that they were entitled, they being Crystal Bay, was entitled to collect prejudgment interest outside of any reserve. In effect, what the district court's ruling did is render the amendment meaningless. And in granting the summary judgment, district court committed numerous errors. First, the district court did not apply the appropriate rules for motions for summary judgments, made factual assumptions and inferences contrary to Crystal Bay, and then ruled against Crystal Bay. Made factual findings not supported within the four corners of the contract documents or anywhere with the record, and directly contrary to the undisputed evidence provided by Crystal Bay. And in relying on paragraph 8B of the original intercreditor agreement, the district court did not consider the amendments, which necessarily impacted paragraph 8B. The district court also entirely misread paragraph 9 of the intercreditor agreement, which required Crystal Bay's consent to voluntary assignments of collateral. And the court stated it meant just the opposite. It only applied to, in the case of a senior default, where it found no senior default and said it didn't apply. Then the court failed. It's at the very least, when you have a provision that says you can collect outside of any interest reserve and that the subordinated interest reserve account no longer exists, but you have a remaining term in the contract that said the subordinated interest reserve still applies, at the very least, those are in conflict and create an ambiguity. And the court is then required under the parole evidence rule to resort to extrinsic evidence to determine the intent of the parties. And that's the real purpose of contract interpretation, to determine the intent of the parties. The district court also allowed a final judgment or result that was unfair and unreasonable and contrary to the Nevada public policy that prohibits creditors like JMA, who purchase a delinquent loan for pennies on the dollar, from reaping windfall profits. And in this instance, the $4 million was entirely a windfall profit. JMA had already been paid at that time $14.5 million for a loan that it paid $10 million for and had released the senior loan. Another provision under paragraph 8B that the court failed to recognize. Paragraph 8B only applies until the senior loan is satisfied. At the time that the court ruled on the motion for summary judgment, the senior loan had been satisfied. JMA had received the $14.5 million and released the senior loan. And again, to the extent that these amendments are not clear, and I think they're clear that they should supersede conflicting language in the existing agreement, but they certainly create a sufficient conflict that the court should have resorted to extrinsic evidence and determine, rather than holding that you could only collect permitted interest from inside a reserve that no longer existed. As I indicated, the court failed to recognize that the parties agreed that you could collect, that Crystal Bay could collect permitted interest outside of any reserve.
The senior loan, just for purposes of clarification, initially the senior loan was for $36 million,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
And then out of that $36 million, you're telling me $14 million plus more was paid on that original $36
million. You don't have all the history of the payments. There was a reserve account set up originally in the original loan of $2 million for the subordinate, $5 million for the senior loan. The senior loan was originally $36 million in principal. It was assigned along with about a dozen other loans originally to a company called Outsource, and I don't know what the consideration was. It was then assigned to OSM. It was then assigned to JMA. JMA paid $10 million for the senior loan. That number we know, and they have already recovered $14.5 million. And in this case, they seek to recover an additional four.
Okay. Possible.
In addition, the court totally misread paragraph 9, by failing to get the consent of Crystal Bay to the voluntary assignments of collateral, the assignments are no longer effective. So, in effect, the subordinated interest or the interest reserve, the intercreditor agreement, was not assigned and is not, therefore, not enforceable by JMA. JMA argues that it wasn't an assignment of collateral. It was a disassignment of the deed of trust, and a deed of trust is not a collateral. Well, this court has held that a deed of trust is an interest in real property. It's clearly collateral. And in the same breath, JMA argues that the guarantee was part of its collateral, but a deed of trust is not. It required under paragraph 9 that you get the consent of Crystal Bay to the assignments of purported assignments. The assignments do not specifically include the intercreditor agreement, but the court found that they did. The district court also erred in awarding prejudgment interest after the a judgment had been entered without prejudgment interest. An appeal filed, a motion was made for prejudgment interest. The court held that prejudgment interest was just the same as attorney's fees. It was collateral to the judgment, and the judge could rule notwithstanding the notice of appeal. It's directly contrary to the federal court's interpretation of Rule 59E. Both the McCullough case and the Osternick case, which are cited, say that prejudgment interest is not a collateral attorney's fees. And the court should have required or followed the procedure set forth in this court, Honeycutt, in the Honeycutt case, to resolve the 59E motion. Would submit to the court that the district court erred in failing to recognize the amendments to the intercreditor agreement. Crystal Bay has the right to continue to collect permitted interest from any source, including the guarantor. The $4 million only represents the payment of permitted interest, and the court's ruling has rendered the amendments meaningless. The district court also has an unreasonable and unfair result that provides a windfall to JMA after it has already been paid in full. At the very least, the amendments to the intercreditor agreement, and when you compare the new provisions with the old provisions, create some conflicts and ambiguities which should have required the court under the parole evidence rule to resort to extrinsic evidence to determine the intent of the parties. Therefore, we respectfully submit to this court reverse the order of the district court and grant summary judgment in favor of Crystal Bay. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Frankovich, you'll have a minute in rebuttal. I'll add a minute to that. Mr. Leonard?
Thank you, Your Honor. Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Ms. Langberg, and there's a principal here from JMA, Todd Chapman. I stand here today basically asking the court to remember a very basic concept in commercial law, something that is really forgotten in this appeal by Crystal Bay. And that is where you have a senior creditor and a junior creditor, and there's a default. As a general rule, the senior creditor collects first. That's Hornbook law. That's first-year law school law. What Crystal Bay is attempting to do here is turn that basic concept on its head. And what they attempted to do in front of Judge Flanagan was argue the conduct of the parties or the loan agreements themselves somehow changed this basic concept. So the question before Judge Flanagan was very simple. Did the intercreditor agreement change these priorities? No. Did the loan modification agreement change these priorities? No. Did the behavior of the parties in settling with the Wittenbergs or the parole evidence offered in front of Judge Flanagan, did that change these priorities? He ruled no. And as I stand here today, I speak to this court, his well-reasoned decision should be affirmed. This case really begins and ends with the intercreditor agreement. It sets out a procedure as to the payment of the junior and the senior lender. It created priorities, the same priorities I'm standing here today saying apply. Senior creditor gets paid first, junior creditor gets paid second. What did the intercreditor agreement provide? It provided for a subordinated interest reserve account. And from that account, the junior lender was allowed to take $75,000 per month as his permitted interest payment. In the case of a default under the intercreditor agreement, paragraph 8B came into effect. And paragraph 8B was quite clear. In the case of a default and an enforcement action was filed, if the junior creditor received a judgment, it could only recover from the sums contained in the subordinated interest reserve account and nothing else until the senior creditor was paid. That's the priority. It was clear. The key to the intercreditor agreement was the priorities are protected and the senior creditor is protected. Now, the Crystal Bay parties would have this court believe that the loan modification agreement turned these priorities on its head. I asked this court to look closely at the loan modification agreement and the senior lender's consent. Because in that consent, all the senior lender agreed to do was modify paragraph 8A1, which is the receipt of default notice from 90 to 30 days, and modify the definition of permitted interest payments to allow these permitted interest payments to be taken outside of the subordinated interest reserve account. Why was that necessary? Because the junior lender wanted to drain the subordinated interest reserve account. In other words, execute in advance. So the senior lender gave the junior lender a concession, allowed them to drain the account, and allowed them to take permitted interest payments outside the account. But what the senior lender did not do in the loan modification agreement was change the priorities. The senior lender did not alter paragraph 8B, which meant if there was an enforcement action brought, the recovery would be limited to what was in the subordinated interest reserve account. If it was nothing, then the senior creditor got paid first. And that's exactly what happened here. Less the recovery expenses. You're absolutely right. I misspoke, and you're certainly correct. The recovery costs were there, and that became an issue in this case, as the court's well aware. So we're clear here. When Crystal Bay filed suit following the second default by the Wittenberg parties, Crystal Bay filed under the intercreditor agreement. It filed an enforcement action under paragraph 8B. If you look at the First Amended complaint, which is in the record, that's exactly how they filed. They brought in, were forced to bring in, my client, by order of the court, my client counterclaimed under paragraph 8B, saying, we have priority to any funds recovered because the subordinated interest reserve account is drained. Well, as you know, there were cross motions for summary judgment based on the clear language of the intercreditor agreement. At the time of those motions, the reason I'm pointing this out, because historically it's an important fact, At the time of those motions, Crystal Bay stood up in court, but through the pleadings, acknowledged the documents themselves, the loan documents themselves, were clear and unambiguous. They were subject to interpretation by the court. JMA made the same representation. Well, as the court knows, Judge Flanagan ruled in favor of JMA, saying, yes, the document is clear and unambiguous, and yes, it is an enforcement action under 8B. Yes, the sworn interest reserve account is drained. Therefore, the senior creditor gets the recovery. The recovery we're talking about is the settlement that was made between Crystal Bay and the Wittenbergs. During the pendency of the litigation before Judge Flanagan, a $4 million settlement was reached between Crystal Bay and the Wittenbergs. My client made a claim to those funds as an enforcement action, as recovery payments. Crystal Bay refused to turn those funds over, which led to the cross motions.
My understanding is that the parties settled, at least JMA settled with the Wettenbergs in a separate JMA action.
Correct.
And I don't quite see an analysis from the judge in discussing the application of 8B that takes into account what he's recited in finding 30 of the findings of fact, which accounts for that settlement. He indicates that it occurred. He indicates that the settlement was reached on August 13, 2014. But I don't see where in 8B the judge accounts for the fact that JMA has reconveyed or transferred the collateral and the note to the Wittenbergs as part of that settlement.
They transferred. That became a dispute between JMA and the Wittenbergs as to what was transferred. JMA specifically withheld the transfer of the intercreditor agreement because they were trying to enforce their rights to the $4 million. They allowed the Wittenbergs requested the JMA transfer to a third party for their own loan benefit because they were attempting to refinance the property. JMA withheld the intercreditor agreement because that's the vehicle in which they were enforcing their rights to the $4 million in front of Judge Flanagan. That's why that document itself or that...
Wasn't the deed of trust assigned to the Wittenbergs?
Yes. It was assigned to a Wittenberg entity, BB Enterprises, I believe is who it was.
Uh-huh. So what's the effect of that assignment under paragraph 9 and as well... was consent required with respect to the prior transfers from Marshall to online to whomever to eventually...
Well, let's start with that. Paragraph 26 of the intercreditor agreement has a one-way assignment provision. The subordinated creditor cannot assign without the specific approval of the senior creditor. There is not the reverse in paragraph 26. The senior creditor is permitted to assign whenever it deems appropriate. So A, Marshall had the right to assign to OSM and outsource and eventually to JMA under paragraph 26. Under paragraph 9, that only comes into effect if there's not a default. At the time of the assignments, with the Wittenbergs were in default. You read paragraph 9 closely. It's a non-issue in a default situation, so it doesn't apply. But let's also take this one step further. They're trying to argue on the one hand that the assignment is somehow invalid. Think about that, how that affects this case. They're arguing on the one hand that loan modification changed the loan priorities. Who executed the loan modification? One of the assignees. It wasn't Marshall. It was OSM or outsource. One of the assignees executed that document. If the assignments are no good, the loan modification's no good. And we're back on the intercreditor agreement, aren't we? So see, they can't have it both ways. They can't have on the one hand saying the assignment's invalid, and oh, by the way, the loan modification still stands. It's either one or the other. Either way, the intercreditor agreement controls. If the intercreditor agreement controls, paragraph 8B controls, and my client was entitled to those funds as Judge Flanagan properly held.
Excuse me, sir. Didn't the parties stipulate to the attorney's fees that were owed Crystal Bay or the recovery expenses?
We stipulated to the amount I was not challenging the billings of Mr. Frankovich's firm. Now, a portion of those fees were challenged as not being a proper recovery cost. But the validity of the charges, being whether they were earned or not, that wasn't being challenged. You see, that's the difference, the distinction I'm trying to draw.
Sure. Here. Had those been challenged in December of 2015? Had JMA retained, you know, and said, "Hey, we're only agreeing. Yes, these are the attorney's fees, but we're challenging you your designation as recovery costs."
Yes.
It's unclear from the order.
Yes, we admitted to the validity that he had billed those sums and he had earned those sums. I mean, we weren't challenging the fact that the work was done. We were saying that the work, a portion of that work, about $200,000, was not a recovery cost. In truth and in fact, it was a lien challenge, which is an exclusion to the recovery cost provisions of the intercreditor agreement.
Thank you.
In an effort to get around the intercreditor agreement, and my time certainly runs short here, the Crystal Bay parties raised a couple of issues. First, to start with the assignment, which I briefly touched on. Secondly, they tried to raise parole evidence in front of Judge Flanagan. And I asked the court closely to look at the parole that they raised. Because on the one hand, they said the documents themselves were clear and unambiguous. Judge Flanagan ruled they were clear and ambiguous, refused to consider the parole. If this court's inclined to consider the parole, look closely at what it is. There is not one email in that parole evidence where the subject of the change to paragraph 8B and the priorities in paragraph 8B is discussed. Also look closely at the Flores and the Blair affidavits. Because both those affidavits do not in any way, shape, or form state there was a discussion with the senior lender where we discussed paragraph 8B. They make an assumption. So what I'm getting at is the parole, even if it's considered, does not alter these agreements. There's also been a reference to the fact that my client settled with the Wittenbergs after the money was held by Crystal Bay in front of Judge Flanagan. I think it was in January 2014 the money was held, and in August 2014 we had the settlement conference in front of Judge Brent Adams, and we settled with the Wittenbergs. The argument is made as twofold. One, since we settled with Wittenbergs, somehow we have waived the breach that occurred 8 months in advance. I believe the law is clear that once a breach occurs, we have a right to recover whether we settle later or whatever. Secondly, let's assume for a second the intercreditor agreement was terminated with the settlement with the Wittenbergs in August 2014. That does not cure the breach of 8 months earlier. What I'm getting at is by magic or whatever, a breach does not occur because a party in good faith settles 8 months later with a third party. That said, I can't stress enough that if you compare the loan modification agreement and what it says and does not say, when you compare that with the intercreditor agreement, it is clear where the priorities lie here. They lie with the senior creditor. Crystal Bay, through fine lawyers or whatever, made a decision and they misinterpreted the agreement when they made the decision themselves to sell to the Wittenberg and hold the money. That decision turned out to be an error. Judge Flanagan got it right. And I'd ask the court to affirm on that basis. I'm asking to reserve 1 minute for my cross appeal.
Okay. Mr. Leonard argues that the priorities in intercreditor agreements must apply. The law is that the language of the agreement is appropriate. They did not subordinate everything. It's clear that they didn't ever subordinate the permitted interest payments. This debate was always both before and after. It was not the intent of the amendment to reduce Crystal Bay's right to permitted interest payment. It was going to enhance it by allowing it to be paid by anybody outside of any reserve. And Mr. Leinart argues today that paragraph 8B still provides that you can only collect it from a reserve. You got one that says you can collect it from a reserve. You got one that says you can collect it outside of any reserve. I think it's important to recognize that the parties recognized that the $4 million payment was a permitted interest payment, which were always allowed to be received under the agreement by Crystal Bay. I'm referring to the release of amended guarantee, which is document JA 3193. Therefore, in consideration of $4 million paid on behalf of the Wittenbergs as guarantors to Crystal Bay as lender for interest obligations constituting permitted interest payments, Crystal Bay hereby completely releases and discharges the Wittenbergs. The parties recognized it was permitted. These were the parties to the original agreement. The Wittenbergs go all the way back. They're not a fourth generation who came in 6 years later and wants to disrupt the whole transaction. And Mr. Weiner said, refer to the affidavits. Please do. And I'm referring to the affidavit of Louis Flores, JA 2371, where who negotiated the amendments, who negotiated with Marshall, who went over it, and indicated in his affidavit that in negotiating the modification agreement, including going forward, Crystal Bay was allowed to accept permitted interest payments outside of any reserve. The parties agreed to modify the language of the intercreditor agreement, which prohibits Crystal Bay from receiving interest payments except from the reserve account, thereby modifying paragraph 8B. That's part of the extrinsic evidence, which explains this conflict in the language that the district court failed to recognize. The district court did not, and the extrinsic evidence in this case was undisputed. Nobody ever filed opposition to it. It did clearly amend it, and Mr. Leinert's argument about the priorities, they were never changed. The priorities were set forth in the agreement that was always provided, and it says in there that they're priorities, and it's except as provided in there, to the extent provided. That is what Crystal Bay is entitled to do. Said that there's only consent under paragraph 9. I always refer to paragraph 26 because it doesn't say anything about the assignment of the loans. But paragraph 9 does. It gives Crystal Bay a limited right to consent only on a voluntary assignment. After the fact, they now claim that it was in connection, that it was a senior default. Nothing in the record supports that there existed a senior default. No senior default notice had been given. And the only limitation in the language in paragraph 9 is it doesn't apply in connection with an assignment in connection with a senior default. None of these assignments were in connection with a default. They were all voluntary, which required the consent of Crystal Bay. Crystal Bay did argue to the district court in its first motion that the amendments made it clear, and they should be read to supersede the terms of the intercreditor agreement, the conflicting terms. The court held otherwise and raised questions, said, well, Marshall wasn't even involved in these negotiations. Where the court came up with that, I don't know. Provided evidence to say they were intimately involved. They negotiated it, and its intercreditor agreements, the amendment to it was intended to modify the intercreditor agreement.
Okay, Mr. Frankovich, you've exceeded your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Leinert, anything further?
It's like a minute 16.
On your rebuttal.
Pardon me?
On your cross
appeal. Yes, sir. On the cross appeal, the issue before Judge Flanagan was the definition of permitted interest payments. And permitted recovery payments. That was not a subject that should have been considered by Judge Flanagan as a permitted recovery payment. That is a lien dispute as to a definition of the contract between JMA as the senior lender and Crystal Bay as the junior lender. That is not, if you look closely at the definition of permitted recovery payments and what is permitted to be recovered in an enforcement action. That is not within that definition. That being the case, I think as Justice Stiglitz asked, a portion of the legal fees awarded to Mr. Frank, to Crystal Bay in this case, were improperly awarded, about $200,000 of it. We didn't challenge around $300,000 of it, because that clearly was a claim against the Wittenbergs, which was a recovery action. To the extent the case was a dispute between my client Mr. Frankovich's client concerning the definition of permitted interest payments and permitted recovery payments, that clearly was not a recovery action. I've used my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent briefs and arguments in this matter. The case will stand submitted.